protection from the fire. And Allah said, that is for the one who seeks forgiveness on the night of decree. Moses again asked, I want your pleasure. Allah said, my pleasure is for the one who performs two rak'ahs of prayer on the night of decree. It is like someone saying, I want cheese. I want butter. I want oil. I want cream. I want clotted cream. They will tell him, all of these are from milk. Whatever you want, it is in the milk. So, the night of Ghad is the source of all mercies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine, tomorrow will be free. resurrection still alive. Oh, yeah. I will caress with my bare hands every precious grain of sand, every stone.
Good day to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. That will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Our final program this hour will be our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed US President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law, has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular case, of mainly, not only, but mainly, I I mean the lethal privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
On the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon for a visit, which he said carries a message of peace.
At times, humanity looks at the Middle East with a sense of trepidation and disheartenment in the face of such complex and long-standing conflicts. Yet in the midst of these struggles, a sense of hopefulness and encouragement can be found when we focus on what unites us, our common humanity, and our belief in a God of love and mercy.
During an interreligious event at Martyrs Square in central Beirut, the Pope listened to representatives from many of Lebanon's 18 officially recognized religious denominations. The Shia cleric asked the Pope to advocate for an end to Lebanon's years-long struggle in the face of Israeli aggression.
We are believers of the significance of the authority of the state, but in its absence, we were forced to defend ourselves and face Israel, which invaded our land. It is not our hobby to take up arms or sacrifice our sons. We therefore put our cause in your hands with what you have of international influence. Perhaps the world can help us out of our crises, primarily the Israeli aggression and its impacts.
Outside the official gatherings, believers await Pope Leo on the main roads to catch a glimpse of the revered figure.
It's a good opportunity to see Pope Leon 14 in our country, and we pray with him for the peace in Lebanon and the Middle East.
The Pope is handling with him a message of peace, a message of love, a message of honor for the country. We are honored to be to him to be with us.
The Pope's recognition of the importance of Lebanon's religious pluralism is considered pivotal, especially at this juncture in time. At the same time, experts believe his visit will most probably not be helpful for Lebanon when it comes to tangible action.
The visit will end within 2 days, and I don't think it will have much impact. We might witness a rise of tension by the Israelis. This is what they have been threatening of. And all we can count on is the capacity of the resistance toward of threats. We cannot, we don't have any other option. No calls for peace, no calls for normalization would have any effect with such a ferocious and criminal enemy such as Israel.
During his visit to Beirut, Pope Leo XIV has prayed for peace in Lebanon and the wider region. However, many fear that his visit is merely a show of symbolic solidarity, one that will neither halt the Israeli aggression against Lebanon, nor will it end the wave of U.S. intimidation targeting the political leadership. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
For weeks, tensions in the Caribbean have been intensifying. The latest flashpoint came after President Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social account that Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed in its entirety. Venezuela quickly slammed the move. The country's foreign minister denounced the move, calling it a colonialist threat and an unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
Venezuela denounces and condemns the colonialist threat that seeks to affect the sovereignty of its airspace, constituting an illegal and unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
As tensions rise over Venezuelan airspace, Washington faces mounting criticism abroad and at home. Cuba and Iran join in condemning Washington's posture, but more is expected from neighboring countries, whose silence so far has raised questions about how the region will respond to escalating U.S.-Venezuela tensions.
But, you know, I think most of the pressure lays on the shoulders of the neighboring countries, and that's to say Brazil, and that's to say also Colombia.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a sharp warning accusing President Trump of reckless actions that could push America into another costly foreign war. He said, Americans are tired of endless foreign wars that cost the lives of countless American service members and drain precious resources. So what is Washington's goal? The U.S. claims its actions are aimed at fighting cartels and drug trafficking. But analysts argue the real objective is to force Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power, either through pressure or the threat of military force.
And so there's a lot already in the region, and if there's even more on top of that, then one would think either that capability is going to be used or it's all sort of trying to demonstrate to President Maduro that it's either you leave the regime now and perhaps dictate some terms that are somewhat agreeable, or there will be a full-scale military operation to unseat you.
The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean, from Panama to El Salvador to Cuba. Critics say the latest pressure campaign against Venezuela fits that pattern, with troops already positioned in the Caribbean and rhetoric heating up. The standoff is no longer just about Venezuela's skies. It's about whether America is prepared to risk a wider conflict in its own backyard.
Crowds filled the 70 square of the Yemeni capital to mark Eid al-Jalal, Yemen's national day celebrating the official end of British rule over South Yemen. What was once a commemoration of the historic liberation has become a platform for Yemenis to reaffirm their opposition to all forms of modern-day foreign occupation. Demonstrators waved pro-resistance flags and chanted slogans against any external interference, emphasizing that the spirit that drove the British out still shapes Yemen's national identity. Former Yemeni Prime Minister Abdelaziz bin Habtoud addressed the rally, condemning Saudi Arabia and the UAE for their interference in Yemen.
Today we are in a battle against the Saudi occupier, who is occupying parts of our lands, and also against the Emirates, who is occupying our islands and provinces. The people who came out today are sending a defiant message to the government that we are ready to defend every ounce of our land.
The main theme of the rally directed strong words at foreign-backed groups inside Yemen.
We came out today to tell the mercenaries and the agents that your end is near, and we are waiting for the orders to fight you and drive you out along with the Saudis and the Emirates.
Tribal leaders also used the occasion to express solidarity with regional resistance movements.
On this Eid al-Jalal, the day our people expelled the last British soldier, we send a message to our brothers in Iran, Hezbollah, and the resistance in Palestine that we are with you. Your enemy is our enemy, and we will never forsake you no matter the challenges we face.
For Yemenis in Sana'a, Eid al-Jalal remains both a reminder of past liberation and a renewed vow to confront any attempts at occupation in Yemen.
The protesters have delivered a clear message. Yemenis will not allow their country to fall under any form of occupation, nor will they tolerate any mercenary forces operating on behalf of foreign powers. Yusuf Audi, Sana'a.
They gathered in huge numbers in the Irish capital on Saturday to mark the UN-recognized International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The national march organized by the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign was backed by more than 170 Irish civil society groups. Protesters are urging the Irish government to finally pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which would prohibit Irish companies from trading with businesses operating inside illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The government made a pledge that they would pass that, and they haven't. And it can't just be about goods, it has to be about services. And the people of Ireland are demanding that. We voted for it, and they're just hiding behind politics.
Campaigners say the so-called ceasefire in Gaza is a fiction, pointing to ongoing Israeli violations and a mounting civilian death toll that adds to the tens of thousands already killed.
I'm opposed to genocide and apartheid, that's why I'm here. I've been marching for 2 years and I'll continue to march.
Humanitarian aid isn't getting in, the medical aid isn't getting in the sort of amounts they need. So it's still pretty desperate, and they're getting into wintertime there. You know, it's cold enough here today, you know. So what's it like if you're living in a tent that's in tatters?
It's a sad day for the world and a sad day for America, a sad day for Britain, sad day for Ireland, that the murder machine of Netanyahu continues.
Yeah, the conditions for people living there are intolerable, and it's not a proper ceasefire, and we're continuing to allow Israel to have people living in apartheid states, and it's not right, and we're right to come out and protest and say it's wrong.
Activists are also calling on the European Union to impose robust sanctions on Israel and to ensure the Netanyahu administration is held accountable in international courts for its crimes against humanity. Because of their complicity and because they're not listening to the electorate, there's a good chance that political parties currently in government right across Europe could be punished when national elections next arise. We've already seen something similar here in Ireland. President Catherine Connolly was elected a landslide victory. She was very anti-establishment and very pro-Palestinian. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
With the Israeli regime routinely violating the so-called ceasefire in Gaza and committing atrocities against the Palestinians in the West Bank, the thousands who have descended upon central London today say the importance of expressing solidarity couldn't be overemphasized.
There's no ceasefire. Gaza's still in a terrible state. The West Bank is creeping into an ever and ever worse state. And the media aren't reporting this, the mainstream media. That's why I'm here. And the least I can do is to be here in a bit of rain when people in Gaza are drowning in their tents in rain.
Organized for the 33rd time, it's a demonstration to also call attention to Britain's ongoing business-as-usual relations with the regime accused of genocide and with its so-called leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
To see Britain and America trashing the international world order in order to support Israel as it commits terrible crimes in Gaza, it's a matter of deep shame.
To the racists in...
On the stage opposite Downing Street, they may not mention their name, but Palestine Action, the direct action group banned under terrorist laws by the Labour government for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturing sites on UK soil, is on many people's mind.
They have managed to mute all resistance all over Europe, and now if you are pro-Palestinian, you are a criminal, or you are, it's like we are losing our democracy here. It's very important to be here today, because this is one step towards fascism, which is developing everywhere.
Everyone knows it's a tra-
There's also sympathy for the six of the 24 activists jailed by the British government for trying to stop those weapons destined for the Israeli regime.
And I think in any other situation, we would hear about these things. You know, we would hear about hunger strikes if they were connected to Ukraine, maybe, or to Sudan or Congo. There's something about Palestine which means they don't even get their voices heard through the people who are trying to be allies with them here, because they're censored.
Nearly 50 years ago, the United Nations named today the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people.
marking Resolution 181 advocating for the partition of Palestine into two states.
And yet another national demonstration terminates outside the halls of power with the thousands who have gathered here saying they're here to assert that ordinary people in Britain refuse to be silent while their government continues to support a regime that is accused of genocide. Cypher is up, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's now time for a short lecture by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani. In this session, he delves into the teachings of the Book for the Hadith by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This book is a profound exploration of ethical and mystical concepts in Islamic spirituality. Let's listen and reflect together.
We had ended our discussion, or left our discussion, on the topic of At-Tawbah from the book of Imam al-Khomeini. So I want to share this one narration from our beloved first Imam, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wasalamu alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And this is in Nahjul Balagha. The narration says the Imam was in the presence of someone who was saying Astaghfirullah. وقال عليه السلام لقائل قال بحذرته استغفر الله. He said to someone who was in his presence who said استغفر الله. The Imam said this. He said ثكلتك أمك أتدري ما الاستغفار. He said, do you even know what you're doing? Do you know what's happening right now? It's a really big deal what you're doing. Because this person, he was saying استغفر الله without really paying attention to the greatness of this moment, the significance of this moment. So the Imam responded to him. He said, "Atadri mal istighfar? Do you know what istighfar is? Al istighfar darajatul aliyin. Istighfar is the status and the place where the great servants of Allah are. You say it like it's not a big deal, like it's just something you're saying and you're moving on. He's saying the inner aspect of this tawbah is a very deep thing. That's what the Imam is trying to say. And then he continues. He says, وَهُوَ إِسْمٌ وَاقِعٌ عَلَى سِتَّةِ مَعَانٍ. He says, when you do istighfar, it has to carry with himself, or ideally it has to carry with itself, six layers. Like you're changing your life altogether. He said, number one, أَوَّلُهَا النَّدَمُ عَلَى مَا مَضَى. Regretting the things that you've done in the past. وَالثَّانِي الْعَزْمُ عَلَى تَرْكِ الْعَوْدِ إِلَيْهَا أَبَدًا. And number two is that you're making the decision that you'll never go back to this ever again. So the Imam said, "Tark al-Audi ilayhi abada." You're making a promise to God in these moments. You're never going to go back to this ever again. You know how big a promise that is? You know how difficult of a promise that is? And this is the same as astaghfirullah. We grab the tasbih, right? Astaghfir, astaghfir, astaghfir. And there's no problem with it. But you have to understand, I have to understand what this means. He says, when you say that 2.5-word phrase, you're making a promise to God, you're never going to go back to this ever again. That has to resonate with me. That has to register for me. That when I'm saying this, I understand what I'm really saying. Not just astaghfirullah, you know, it's not a big deal. He said, that's number two. Number three, وَالثَّالِثُ أَن تُؤَدِّي إِلَى الْمَخْلُوقِينَ حُقُوقَهُمْ. That you're actually going to go back and return to people the rights that you took away from them. You hurt this person, you're going to apologize to him. You took from the wealth of this person, you took from the reputation of this person. Yes? You're going to actually go back and do this. Sometimes you know who they are, you go back to them directly. Sometimes you don't know who they are. That's why our fuqaha say, a lot of times, it comes with more details, but this is the general idea. That if you don't know who they are, or you know who they are, but you don't have access to them anymore, that you have to pay sadaqah on their behalf. You have to do raddul mazalim, as they refer to it in fiqh. Okay. When you say istighfar, you're also making this promise. You're not just sitting there and saying something. You're making all these promises in this one moment. That's number three. It says number four, وَالرَّابِعْ أَن تَعْمِدَ إِلَى كُلِّ فَرِيدَةٍ عَلَيْكَ ذَيَّعْتَهَا فَتُؤَدِّي حَقَّهَا. You're also making a fourth promise, and that is whatever you miss with Allah, you're going to go back and make it up to Him as well. This is all in this 2 seconds you said astaghfirullah. It's a big deal. And he says, حَتَّى تَلْقَ اللَّهَ أَمْلَسْ لَيْسَ عَلَيْكَ تَبِعَ. Then if you repent to Allah in this way, then you'll meet Allah. Yes, you won't be carrying any burden with you anymore. Now you meet Allah, and you are pure to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then he adds number five and number six. And again, the reason why he's adding number five and number six is to show the ideal form of tawbah. This number five and number six is above my pay grade. So I'm just mentioning it because it's part of the narration. And the Imam is mentioning it to say this is, you know, the ideal form of tawbah. For you and I, or for me, this is not necessarily part of tawbah. He's saying ideal. If you really want to do at a really high level, this is going to sound a bit difficult. He says, وَالْخَامِسْ أَن تَعْمِدَ إِلَى اللَّحْمِ الَّذِي نَبَتَ عَلَى السُّحْتِ. The flesh that you grew during the time of your sinning, you're going to turn towards that and you're going to melt it. You're going to make things difficult upon yourself, yes? You're going to eat less, you're going to fast to remove that flesh that you grew during the time of your sinning. And he says, until a point comes where now the bone and the skin are close to each other. That's why I said it's above my pay grade. And this is not what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects from you and I for a normal tawbah. These are extra levels. If you want to add to it, for the special servants of God, this is what. But he's trying to explain what istighfar truly is. It's like it's this big of a deal. You don't just say istighfar and move on. And that's number five. He says number six was sadis. And tuziqa al-jisma alam al-ta'a. That you would make your body feel the difficulty of obeying Allah. When you were sinning, you were indulging in pleasures. Now you do the opposite of it. So you were sinning, you were partying, whatever the case might be. Now you do the opposite of it. You stand in prayer for longer. You go to sujood for longer. You have your soul feel the difficulty of ibadah more. فَعِنْدَ ذَلِكَ. And with this I will end. He says, when you do this, فَعِنْدَ ذَلِكَ تَقُولُ أَسْتَغْفِرُ اللَّهِ. Then you say astaghfirullah and now you're really meaning it. Now again, I can't emphasize enough. Number five and number six, these are for the special servants of Allah. Allah doesn't expect this from us. The first four are the critical parts of a tawbah. First four, if you do them without these first four, then your tawbah is not even accepted. Yes? Five and six are for the special servants of Allah. But the Imam is trying to explain, listen, then you can say astaghfirullah. Then you mean what you're talking about. Otherwise, you and I just come and say astaghfirullah and we're not really meaning it in this sense, then if we were there, the imam would tell us the same thing. Like, what are you talking about? Atadri ma al-istighfar? Do you have any idea what you're even saying? Al-istighfaru darajatul aliyin. This is good news for all of us, that if this istighfar is available to us, then we can immediately take ourselves from a person who is disobedient to Allah, who Allah does not like, who Allah has distanced himself from him, to a person who is beloved by Allah and is close to Allah. All it takes is a firm intention. All it takes is these four things that I really, at the bottom of my heart, I decide to return to Allah, and then I become amongst those who are beloved in the eyes of Allah. And that is why our beloved first Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wasalamu alayhi, he has a famous line. He says, "Ajibtu, I am surprised at the one who yaqnats. I'm surprised as the one who loses hope. Wa ma'ahu al-istighfar." And he still has istighfar available to him. How are you losing hope when in a matter of second you can go from being distanced by Allah or from Allah to being beloved by Allah? When you have istighfar in your hands, there's no reason to ever lose hope.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. Say that love strikes only once, that precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? You are my guiding light that walks me through the night. Your presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease. Someday there'll be justice, someday there will be. Possess, I offer you. I wanna be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is please, where is the swing?
fall of Bashar al-Assad, a fleeting wave of hope swept across Syria. For a brief moment, many believed a better future was within reach. But those dreams quickly dissolved. The new dawn proved a mirage. Instead of renewal, Syria plunged deeper into crisis. I'm Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this is In a Nutshell. Power fractured, Israel seized the moment. Exploiting the chaos, it launched hundreds of strikes across Syrian territory and quietly expanded its footprints in the south. In the 2 days following Assad's overthrow, Israel carried out more than 500 airstrikes, targeting both military and civilian infrastructure. Since then, it has been occupying swaths of Quneitra and Daraa under the banner of preventing extremist threats. Since Assad's fall, Israel's military presence has evolved from opportunistic incursions into a strategic project, one aimed at reshaping southern Syria to fit its security and economic map. From Quneitra to Jabal al-Sheikh, also known as Mount Hermon, Israeli forces have entrenched themselves along key highlands, water basins, and energy corridors. The new balance of power in the Levant increasingly revolves around two words, water and gas. Jabal al-Sheikh, the highest peak in the region, stands as the crown jewel of this expansion.
At 2,814 meters, it offers an unrivaled surveillance hub, giving Israel a panoramic view from Damascus to the Mediterranean and deep into Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. To the southwest, Israeli forces have fortified Quneitra, extending their reach to within 20 kilometers of central Damascus. New positions in Rahla, opposite Lebanon's Baqa Valley, now oversee three key routes linking Damascus to Beirut and Baalbek, effectively giving Israel a hand on Syria's western gateways. In Soweida province, Israeli influence is spreading under the guise of supporting the Druze. Following the July 2024 formation of the so-called National Guard, a 3,000-strong Druze force reportedly funded by Israel, Tel Aviv's reach deepened. Netanyahu's public pledges to protect the Druze community signaled more than goodwill. They marked the birth of a semi-autonomous security zone loosely tied to Damascus. Beneath the rhetoric of security, however, lies a contest for control over energy routes and water reserves, the true currency of power in today's Levant. The revival of the long-stalled Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline has only sharpened these rivalries. Once blocked by Assad to protect Russian interests, the project roared back into life after its fall. In December 2024, Turkey's energy minister announced its potential restart once Syria stabilizes. For Israel, that's a red flag. A functioning Qatar-Turkey-Europe pipeline would undercut Israel's own East-Med pipeline ambitions, a direct challenge to its vision of becoming Europe's next gas supplier.
Analysts at the Begin Sadat Center warn that this gas race pits two visions against each other. Ankara's dream of an Islamic energy corridor versus Tel Aviv's push for a Mediterranean one. Both see Syria as the crucial crossroads.
But Israel's ambitions go beyond gas. Control of water, the lifeblood of the region, has become another front. Through its hold over the Yarmouk River basin and the Al-Wehda Dam on the Syrian-Jordanian border, Israel now wields a strategic lever over both Syria and Jordan. The Golan Basin alone provides nearly a third of Israel's agricultural water needs, and every step deeper into southern Syria secures that lifeline. From Jabal al-Sheikh to Daraa, Israel's control of springs, rivers, and dams, including Banyas, Raqqad, and Al-Manitra, has turned southern Syria into a meticulously managed zone of influence. In this reshaped landscape, fertile lands once tilled by Syrian farmers are being eyed for Israeli agricultural expansion, their crops destined for regional markets. These same corridors, rich in water and soil,
double as potential land routes for future pipelines stretching from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean or Turkey. The fall of Assad was supposed to bring about a bright season for Syria. Instead, it opened a new chapter of domination, one where Syria, fragmented and exhausted, has become a playground for power politics and expansionist ambitions. Israel's quiet conquest of the south is not just about borders, it's about resources, leverage, and rewriting the strategic map of the Levant. Militaries and defense companies across the globe have quietly pivoted. The Shahed loitering munition and inexpensive long-range kamikaze drone from Iran is no longer a curiosity, it's the blueprint. I'm Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and welcome to another episode of In a Nutshell. A recent Wall Street Journal report confirmed what's been whispered in corridors of power. Firms in the US, China, France, and the UK are racing to produce armed UAVs modeled directly after the Iranian design. What used to be a market dominated by expensive Western systems is now being reshaped by cheap, mass-producible replicas of the Shahed. Western militaries once scoffed at Tehran's drone programs. For years, pundits and outlets dismissed Iranian claims. Remember the Atlantic's 2012 jeer over a VTOL drone and accusations in other press that Tehran doctored images? Systems like the Karrar and the Qaher 313 were ridiculed, and analysts underestimated Iran's industrial persistence. That derision has given way to grudging respect. Prototypes on display at a U.S. Department of Defense event this summer included designs strikingly similar to the Shahed, signaling an uncomfortable truth. An Iranian-designed weapon has changed the rules. So, arms makers are moving fast. Examples include Spectreworks Lucas, low-cost uncrewed combat attack system, a delta-wing drone aiming for a $35,000 unit price and explicitly designed to emulate the Shahed for training and offensive roles. Griffin Aerospace Arrowhead, originally presented as a target drone to train defenses against Shahed-style threats. Corporations in China, France, and the UK are also incorporating Shahed design elements into exports and anti-ship loitering munitions. China's CH series and an almost identical Sunflower 200 VTOL with propeller, no booster, are examples. The strategic pivot reached the political mainstream in May of 2025. During a visit to Qatar, U.S. President Donald Trump praised Iranian drones as very good, fast, and deadly. He slammed the military-industrial complex for the eye-watering price gulf and urged America to learn from Iran's cost-efficient design. What makes the Shahed so disruptive isn't dazzling tech, so much as ruthless, pragmatic design. Type: Shahed 136, loitering munition, kamikaze drone, airframe, delta wing, pusher propeller, wingspan, approximately 2.5 meters, mass, approximately 200 to 250 kilograms, speed, 185 to 200 kilometers per hour, range, estimated up to 2,500 kilometers, warhead, 40 to 50 kilogram high explosive, launch, simple mobile racks, minimal infrastructure, design goal, ultra-low cost, mass production, saturation attacks. Economics is the weapon. Defenders may fire a multi-million dollar Patriot missile at a target that cost Iran tens of thousands to build, launched en masse from dispersed locations with small radar signatures and low flight paths. Shahed-style swarms can overwhelm modern air defenses. The Shahed story is a case study in asymmetric innovation. Under sanctions and international pressure, Iran pursued cost-effective, mass-produced weapons that changed battlefield equations. The result? A dramatic shift in procurement priorities, from expensive interceptors to affordable mass drones. Western militaries that once dismissed Iranian systems, now copying them. economic mismatch, cheap attackers versus expensive defenders, a strategic headache for states relying on legacy air defense doctrines, a new baseline for unmanned systems. The Shahed is now the standard many future systems will be measured against. What began as a mocked program has become a design template. The Shahed 136 didn't just strike targets, it rewired global military thinking. Western firms and arsenals are racing to catch up, copy, and cheapen their own offerings because the future of long-range, low-cost strikes looks a lot more like Tehran's playbook than anyone expected.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazan in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by Kids Corner. The program is all about children and child's play, a fun program specially made for children. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something. And not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh,
gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. But thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Israel has once again violated the Gaza ceasefire deal as the Palestinian territory witnesses fresh attacks by the regime's military. International humanitarian organizations and UN agencies call for urgent medical evacuation of tens of thousands of patients from the Gaza Strip. And military delegations from member states of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization are in Iran to attend a five-day anti-terrorism drill. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Israeli air and artillery strikes have once again battered different parts of the Gaza Strip in violation of the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. In one of the latest attacks, Israeli forces killed a Palestinian west of the so-called Yellow Line in the Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. Several others were also injured when a school sheltering displaced families was struck in the same city. In southern Gaza, four consecutive air raids targeted eastern